Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, in these quarrelsome times, advice for arguing well. We'll spend this hour with mathematician Eugenia Chang, who is eager to remind us that the elegant logic of mathematics is useful beyond the realm of numbers. It can help us explain and justify our own ideas and evaluate the cases other people make for their conclusions. We'll learn how logic can prove us right and that it's possible to be logical and also wrong. We'll also hear why Chang doesn't think emotions need to be checked at the door when we're making a logical appeal. Our conversation starts after a short break. And Beto O'Rourke debate, you could be forgiven for thinking they grew up on different planets rather than in the same state.
Listening to Rhonda Hart, who lost her daughter Kimberly in the Santa Fe shooting, she tells me bringing weapons into those classrooms would not have saved her daughter's life. It will not make us safer. Thoughts and prayers, Senator Cruz, are just not going to cut it anymore. The people of Texas, the children of Texas deserve action.
Well, hold on a second, and let me be very clear. More armed police officers in our schools is not thoughts and prayers. I'm sorry that you don't like thoughts and prayers. I will pray for anyone in harm's way, but I'll also do something about it.
When you listen to the guy you like, you think the choice should be obvious, right? How does the other guy not realize he's just wrong? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The fact that the polls put Cruz and O'Rourke neck and neck these days make the choice look binary, although, in fact, there is a libertarian named Neil Dykeman on the ballot as well. But the thing is, a lot of the issues they disagree about are not binary. There are many ways to frame and solve what's not working in America, and the truth can lie in the gray areas between polar opposites. It's often more complicated to deal with shades of gray, but mathematical thinking, the core stuff of logic, it can help us understand what our adversaries believe, and it can help us understand our own ideas. Eugenia Chang is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Her new book is called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. She joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago to talk about it. Eugenia, welcome to Think.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
You describe logic as a kind of life jacket for those of us who are drowning in the illogic of the modern world. Why are we struggling to even know the difference between truth and lies these days?
Well, it does sometimes seem like we're drowning in illogic all around us. And one reason is that our arguments have become more and more divisive, with people being pushed to further and further opposite extremes when they don't really need to be like that. And it can seem that we believe in truth and other people are just telling lies. But I think that we need to be careful about making that very black and white statement itself, because there are different ways of accessing truth, and there isn't really any way of saying definitely what is true. There is what seems to be backed up by evidence. There's what seems to be backed up by widely corroborated news reports. And then there is also what is backed up by logic. And that is where mathematics can come in and help us.
So how is it that mathematicians can always agree about what is true, at least mathematically true?
Math is often thought of as being just about numbers and equations and having right and wrong answers. But that's unfortunately a limited view of math, and possibly just what you might have experienced in school and classes that you remember at school. But actually, math is a framework for agreeing on things, because in order to say that something is true, we have to provide a very rigorous logical argument for it, starting by declaring what our starting points are. So we always have to start with some basic assumptions, otherwise we won't be able to deduce anything. And then if somebody disagrees with us, it's not enough for them simply to say, I disagree with you, you're obviously stupid. What they have to do is find a flaw in your logical argument and point out what the flaw in the logic is, or else they have to admit that actually, your logic is sound, but we disagree at the very fundamental starting points. And those two things are slightly different ways of disagreeing that I think are quite important.
Okay, I'm with you so far, except that real life can be so much more nuanced than the components of a really abstract mathematical equation. So how can math help us if we can't eliminate uncertainty from the questions we want to answer?
math can help us understand what the terms are that we're even talking about, and it can help us understand where it is that we're disagreeing. Yes, the nuances in life are very slippery, and the trouble is that we are not very good at being precise and dealing with those nuances. So one thing that happens when there's a grey area around is that some people just completely ignore the grey area and only talk about the black and white at the extremes. And that's a big mistake because it means that we're just neglecting an entire part of the argument. Another problem is if we try and draw a line in the grey area, and this happens with, for example, questions of sexual harassment, what counts as acceptable flirtatious behaviour, and then where does it cross the line into sexual harassment? Wherever you try and draw a line in a grey area is going to cause some strange problems, because then you can say, well, what about that thing that was just a tiny bit better than that, or just a tiny bit worse? Are we really going to call one of those things terrible and one of those things fine? But at least being aware of the abstract difference between completely omitting the grey area and trying to draw a line in it, for example, draws our attention to where the problems are and what people are really trying to say.
How does logic in mathematics compare to evidence in science?
I sometimes like to say that logic plays the role in mathematics that evidence plays in science. And really, all academic disciplines are giving us a framework for deciding what's going to count as true. So in science, the framework is evidence. You collect evidence and you see whether it supports what you think is true or not. And in the end, it's always a statistical deduction. You say that you're 95% sure or that you're 99% sure, which means that there is overwhelming evidence to support it. There is still a tiny possibility that something else is going on, but you would need to find more evidence to really switch your view about that. And that's an important point, that all these frameworks for accessing truth also come with a framework for saying when something is not true. And that's a really important part of these frameworks. Now, in mathematics, in abstract mathematics, we don't use evidence, we use logic. So something counts as true in the framework of that logical system if you can deduce it just using logical steps. So if this is true, then this has to be true, and then this has to be true, starting from some basic assumptions that you have declared up front. So we have to make clear what it is that we're starting with. And in mathematics, those are called axioms. And then what we've created is a logical world in which some things are true according to the logic of that world. And I think this is an important distinction, because when we look at other people and we say they're being illogical, they might not have used bad logic. They might simply be in a different logical world with different starting points. And what that really means is that somebody has different, completely fundamental beliefs that are different from ours. And that doesn't mean they're being illogical. It means that there's something fundamental that we need to think about before we can even think about the logic of their argument.
Okay, so let's look at the debate over whether to expand or cut social services. It helps to step back and recognize, as you just mentioned, both sides are using logic to arrive at their conclusion about the right course of action. But of course, they've come up with very different conclusions.
Yes. Yeah, so there are possible illogical arguments, but there are also possible logical arguments that disagree with each other. Because one type of person might say we should expand social services because there are so many vulnerable people who need help and we're currently neglecting them. And then there's another kind of person who says we should not have so much social services because they're expensive, we can't afford it, and we're encouraging people to be lazy by providing them with safety nets instead of making sure that they work hard to support themselves. And those are both logical arguments if you trace them back to a different underlying assumption. And I think it comes down to a question of false positives and false negatives. So on the one hand, the person who wants to cut back on social services is really bothered by the idea of helping people who they don't think really need help. So that's a false positive, where you're doing something for someone when you don't think that they deserve it. The other kinds of people are really bothered by neglecting people who do deserve help. And that's a false negative, where we're failing to do something that we should have done. And those are two very fundamentally different positions. And if we trace it back to that, then we realize that, well, I think we should be really having a conversation about who deserves help and who doesn't, and why some people are so bothered by the idea of helping people unnecessarily, But they're not so bothered by the idea of neglecting people who really deserve it. And then we can talk about where the gray area is and where the line should be drawn. So can we all agree, for example, that tiny babies who've just been born, whose parents died in a terrible accident, do those babies deserve help? Maybe there's somewhere where we can all agree, and then we can edge our way along and gradually find that there are things that we actually agree on. We're not actually at polar opposites, even though arguments in the current climate make us feel like we're at polar opposites.
Of course, there are more than two options here, right? We can cut social services. We can expand social services. We can also leave them unchanged. We could create some new services while eliminating others. Why, Eugenia, do we get so often hung up on arguing over only two options?
I think that we're all trying to understand a very, very complicated world around us. And one very tempting way to simplify it is to cut down on the number of options there are. Unfortunately, that is simplistic. It's not just simplifying it, and it often neglects some important nuances. Now, I like to say that a better way to simplify the world around us is to become more intelligent, because then the world becomes simpler relative to our brains. And I think that's a much better way to simplify the world around us, so that if we learn how to deal with nuance, then we don't have to get rid of it in order to understand the world around us. Now, another problem that makes these arguments into divisive two-option-only arguments is attention spans and, unfortunately, the idea of tweets that can only last 280 characters and memes that go viral but have hardly any space for any words on them. And most arguments are much more complicated than that, and you can't fit them into a 30-second soundbite or a gripping headline or a 280-character tweet. And so it is tempting to squash a nuanced point into a tiny little box like that so that it will go viral.
You remind us here about the importance of the directionality in logic. Why is it so important to understand that logic flows in one direction only?
Yes, logic does flow in one direction. You say, from this thing that we know, we can deduce this other thing. It doesn't mean that we can go backwards. And people make mistakes like that with the directions in logic and think that they're showing that something is equivalent to something else when they got the logic going in the wrong direction. And this can cause confusion if you're not really clear about directions that things are going. So I've seen, for example, arguments on the internet, that wonderful source of fantastic arguments, where people seem to think that everyone who is an immigrant in this country is illegal. And that is logic flowing in a completely wrong direction. Because, yes, there are some immigrants who have entered the country illegally, but that doesn't mean that all of them have entered the country illegally. There are perfectly legal ways to enter this country. And so when logic flows in the wrong direction, then you can end up with extreme and aggravating and, unfortunately, very emotive statements that are wrong.
Okay, so there's the way that mathematicians use logical negation, and there's the way that most of us use opposites in everyday conversation. What's the difference?
Yes, the opposites in ordinary conversation are where you say, that concert was fantastic, and someone says, no, it wasn't. That concert was terrible. And whereas a logical mathematical negation is where one person says, that concert was fantastic, and the other person says, I don't think it was fantastic. It was just quite good. And that quite good is still not the same as saying it was fantastic. So that would count as a way of negating the statement by saying, I disagree that it was fantastic. But in order to disagree, you don't have to go all the way to the opposite extreme and say it was terrible. You can just have a slightly more nuanced view about it. Or maybe you can say some of it was fantastic and some of it wasn't. Or you can say, well, it might have been fantastic for you, but here are some things I didn't like about it. And these are the traps we fall into when we evaluate any action by a public figure or any proposed new bill or some kind of public policy or something. You tend to get one side saying, this is great, this is fantastic, and the other side saying, this is awful, it's immoral, it has to be stopped, instead of saying something more nuanced, which is, this thing will help these people. but it will hurt these other people. And then we can weigh up who is it that we want to help, and is it worth hurting those other people in order to help these people?
Eugenia Chang is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and author of a new book called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Eugenia Chang, who is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and author of The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. First of all, Eugenia, before we go further, what does a scientist in residence do at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago?
Well, mostly what I do is have a fantastic time teaching art students. It's a liberal arts school in Chicago, but everyone is doing some kind of fine art degree. But because it's liberal arts, they have a broad education covering all ways of thinking. And the school believes that education is about thinking and that there shouldn't really be boundaries between subjects in quite the way that we've put them there, so that art and science shouldn't be as thought of as different in quite the extreme way that they often are. And so science is taught as a way of thinking that's important to everybody, including art students. So I teach abstract mathematics to art students, and it's a great place to be.
Oh, that sounds really nice. All right. Sometimes on this show, when we talk about white privilege, we will hear from people who say, I'm white, but I can't possibly have white privilege. I grew up poor. I know lots of people of color who are doing better than I am. And you say this is a faulty implication. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So I hear that argument a lot as well. And I think it's important for us to sympathize with those white people who really feel that they're struggling. But it's also important for us to explain what white privilege really means. White privilege, at least according to the theory of privilege that I believe in, white privilege doesn't mean that all white people are supposed to be better off than all non-white people. What it's saying is that if you had all of those same characteristics, but you were also not white, then you would be even worse off in society. And we know that, yes, there are some rich black people. There are some super rich black sports stars, but that doesn't negate the existence of white privilege, because there are even richer super rich white sports stars. And there are things that black people suffer in this society that white people do not have to deal with, such as the fear of being stopped by the police and the fear of having the police called on you when you're just minding your own business in a place that you're allowed to be, but somebody feels threatened by you. So things like that are what would make it even worse to be that white person who believes that they don't have privilege, but they're not understanding that it means if they were also not white, then they would have even less privilege. But I think it's important for us to acknowledge that there are white people, and especially white male people who also have what we call male privilege, who feel really hard done by, and they don't feel that they actually experience any benefit to being white and male. And this makes them very angry about the theory of privilege and the whole idea of the so-called identity politics. And I think it's really important for us to acknowledge where that anger comes from, instead of simply getting angry at them in return and yelling at them that they are privileged. We have to explain these things rather than just shout.
This is a good time to note that you don't think that we have to strip the emotion from every conversation that involves logic.
That's right. We are emotional human beings, and that's important. That's what sets us apart from being robots or the AI that so many people are afraid of that might take us over later. But our emotions are an important thing that complements or should complement our logic. It doesn't have to be a battle between emotions and logic, because the thing is that emotions are always real and they're always true. You can't just tell someone they're not feeling an emotion. If they are, it's much more helpful to try and understand why they're feeling that emotion. And emotions are what one of the things that should help us to build relationships with other people and empathize with them. But we can use logic as well to understand where people's emotions are coming from. So if I don't feel the same emotion as somebody else, I can still use logical steps to understand what is causing them that emotion and why I am not having the same emotion.
How can logic help us understand who's to blame for something that goes wrong?
Blame is another situation where we tend to oversimplify because that's easier. And there is a tendency for everyone to want to blame one person in a situation. And so, for example, after the election result, there was all sorts of finger pointing where people saying it's just the fault of, and then they narrow it down to one group of people. However, in mathematical logic, there's a way of joining statements together using the word and. And if you have two things causing a result, it's something and something else. So to take a less controversial example, if I drop my glass and the floor is hard, then it will break. And it's both of those things together that cause the glass to break. If I hadn't dropped my glass, then it wouldn't have broken. But also, if the floor hadn't been hard, then perhaps it wouldn't have broken. That doesn't mean that me dropping it or the floor being hard are individually to blame, even though changing one of them will change the outcome. And that is true for, I think, probably every situation that we ever come in the world. I'm sure there is never a situation that is caused by exactly one factor. It's caused by a whole collection of factors together with the environment that joins those factors together to cause a situation. So just to take the example of the election again, some people say that they think it's all the fault of people who voted third party because their votes didn't count for anything. However, we should also take into account the fact that the voting system is the thing that causes third party votes not to count. And so it's a combination, even just looking at that single factor, it's a combination of people voting third party and the voting system that means that those votes don't count for anything. So that's already a more nuanced way of thinking about who is to blame in a situation.
It seems as if presenting our own arguments with pretty foolproof logic will convince people to agree with us. And Eugenia, you and I both know that almost never happens. So why doesn't logic work to change the minds of people who disagree with us?
Logic is a very powerful way of constructing unambiguous arguments, but unfortunately, it's not a very powerful way of convincing people of things emotionally. And actually, even in research mathematics, we don't necessarily use the logical proof to convince other people. We use the logical proof to verify that something really does count as true. But when we're explaining it to people, we give the idea behind it. We talk about how we came up with that idea in the first place. And we try to make some emotional connection with the things we're talking about rather than just the hard and fast logic. Although it's the hard and fast logic that makes us really sure that we're right. And I think that this is something we can learn for use in convincing people of non-mathematical arguments as well. That if the logic alone doesn't convince them, then we need to understand why it is that they're clinging to some other belief. And if they feel something really emotional that contradicts the logic, then the logic isn't ever going to win. I think that if we pit logic and emotions in a battle against each other, emotions will always win. And I think that most people experience that with strong emotional reactions to something that you can't necessarily explain. And my personal example of this was that I used to be very afraid of flying, despite the fact that the statistics say flying is much safer than, for example, getting in a car. But I'm not afraid of getting in a car. And no matter how many times I read these statistics, I was still afraid of flying. And so you could say to me, I was just being illogical. But the trouble is that would never convince me to change my mind. If you tell someone you're just being illogical, then probably what they're going to do is cling to their belief even harder to prove that you're wrong and that they're right. Whereas what I did instead was I tried to find the logic behind my fear. And I realized it wasn't the probability of dying that I was afraid of. It was just the thought of dying. Just even the considering it popping into my head was what made me afraid. And I realized that it was the act of takeoff. It was the sound of takeoff that reminded me of the idea of possibly dying. And so actually all I needed to do was learn how to distract myself from the sound of takeoff so that the thought of dying didn't pop into my head. And then I was able to fix my fear of flying.
So if we want to always be right, we can just attach qualifiers to our statements. Is that right?
I think mostly, yes.
Mostly.
I should qualify that statement just right. to make sure. So the point here is that people are trying to be right too much, I think, and trying to show that everyone else is wrong. And my wonderful PhD supervisor, Martin Hyland, always taught us to say, well, there is a sense in which something, something, something. And this focuses our attention on the fact that there is truth in things, even if we disagree with the statement overall. And so when we're disagreeing with someone, it can really help to say, what is the sense in which they have a point? And what is the sense in which I have a point? Rather than trying to say, I'm right and you're wrong. And it is very much more dramatic and exciting to make some kind of sweeping statement. And it can also be very therapeutic. And so for those of us who have, for example, experienced a lot of bad sexual behavior from men around us, it can be really tempting to say, oh, all men are terrible sexual harassers. And it's therapeutic, but not particularly helpful because it's a sweeping statement. And in fact, there are, I believe, some decent men out there. And so it can be more helpful to say something like, in my experience, there are so many men out there who behave badly that it is very, very tiresome and difficult for women in a public place. And then we can think about the sense in which that's true and the experiences of women and how exhausted women are from having to protect themselves from predators in public places every single day of their lives, rather than just having some fight about whether all men are terrible people or not.
What kinds of decisions can logic not really help us with?
Logic has limits, and the long history of research in mathematics has shown us those limits. And we've already talked about the limits that logic has at the beginning, because you can't deduce anything from nothing. So you have to take some basic starting points, and those would be our fundamental personal beliefs. So those fundamental beliefs come from somewhere that isn't necessarily logic. It often comes from families or upbringing or religious beliefs or culture or from tribalism. That's a place that people's fundamental beliefs often come from these days. Logic has other limits. Sometimes we don't have enough information to be able to use logic fully. And so, for example, some people say, if we raise minimum wage, then people will lose their jobs because there won't be so much work around. And the thing is, that isn't a logical statement. That is a theory, and we don't necessarily have enough information to be able to tell whether that's really true or not. Another case where logic has limits is where it causes a paradox. And paradoxes are things that mathematicians and philosophers have studied for thousands and thousands of years. And that's where a logical statement can cause a contradiction somehow inside itself. And mathematics teaches us that to get out of those paradoxes, we have to shift our level somehow. And one paradox that can be caused by trying to be too logical is very important in some of the issues that are going on in the world around us at the moment, to do with sexual harassment and the idea that we should always assume that people are innocent until they're proved guilty. And that's an important principle about trials and law. However, in a case where somebody is accusing someone else of a sexual crime, we can't hold both people innocent until proved guilty. Because if we hold the accused person innocent until proved guilty, that means that we're accusing the accuser of making a false accusation. And if we hold them both innocent, then that causes a contradiction because they can't actually both be innocent. And so I think that's a case where we have to take the levels out of, take some different level and get out of the loop by saying, well, seeing as we can't hold them both innocent until proven guilty, we have to err in one direction or the other. And we have to decide who will benefit and who will be hurt from the erring that we do. And I think that by erring always on the side of thinking that the accused person is innocent until proved guilty, we are creating an environment in which too many people can get away with sexual harassment. And once they believe they can get away with it, that they do it more. And I think this is the so-called rape culture that we are creating by erring that way. And we're hurting all the victims of sexual harassment all over the world. And that we need to do something. If we care, the question is, do we care more about the victims whose lives are ruined by sexual harassment, or the people who are accused who might be innocent? And actually, it's another example of false positives and false negatives, again, which links up to the example of social services that we were talking about earlier.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go to the phones now. We have Linda on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having this discussion. I was just curious about, you know, taking the sort of nuance out, you know, out from the theory and logic into the real world. And when politicians are different but not that different, they tend to get lumped together. And that's why we end up making these huge differences that maybe aren't a reflection of reality. And how do we, like, bring some logic into that, or maybe not, if that makes sense?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Well, it's an interesting point where we lump people in together and we also lump people into opposites. And there's a logical fallacy of false dichotomy and false equivalence, where one is we say that somebody is just like somebody else when they're somehow not. And the other is where we say that they're totally opposite when they're also not. And if we could be more nuanced about it, we would try to say, here is a sense in which these two politicians are similar, together with a sense in which they are different. And then we can, instead of saying, yes, they're the same, no, they're different, yes, they're the same, we can say, well, is the sense in which they're the same more relevant than the sense in which they're different for this particular discussion at the moment? Because you might disagree about something that doesn't have any particular influence or relevance to the discussion at hand, but the point of disagreement might be relevant to the discussion at hand. And I think that would be much more nuanced than simply saying lumping people in together or not. And unfortunately, it's a consequence of two-party politics, where you're kind of with people or you're against them. And it would be much less divisive if it could be a bit more fluid than that.
My guest is Eugenia Chang. She's scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and she has a new book out called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Eugenia Chang, who's scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and whose new book is called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, I want to talk about what I'm going to call the cookie problem after having read your book, but I know that there's a better term for it. So if we don't acknowledge there's a gray area in arguments, we can make some really serious errors in judgment. So I decide it's okay to eat one cookie because it's not going to blow my diet, because what's one cookie?
Mm-hmm.
But then it's faulty logic for me to assume that if I had one cookie yesterday, I can eat an unlimited amount of cookies today and not have to buy new pants.
Right. It's a mistake that I fall into as well. I go, oh, well, one. And people say this the whole time. Oh, one bite won't hurt. And so if one bite won't hurt, then how about the next bite? Well, that bite won't hurt. And then what about the next bite? Well, one bite won't hurt. And then suddenly you've had 63 bites and it hurts. And right. I've done that many times myself. And I know that the logic of the situation is not enough to stop me from doing it. So you can take an extreme position. So the logic says that in order to get out of that, you need to take one of two extreme positions. Either just declare that having infinitely many bites is fine, and that is a way to do things, or you have to go for total abstinence and say, well, zero bites is the only number of bites that is okay. And there are some foods where it is helpful for me to do that, but you can't do that with all food because you've got to eat something.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that comes up in all the places where we try to draw a line. So it happens with children's bedtimes because, of course, if we decide that their bedtime is 9 o'clock, then 9:01 actually isn't going to make that much difference. But then they say, oh, well, I just needed a glass of water. And then it's 9:03. And then they say, oh, I'm cold. I need an extra blanket. And then it's 9:06. And then they say, oh, I forgot to put this book away. And then it's 9:08. And then on it goes. And they know that they can just push it by a little bit each time and then gradually get their bedtime later and later. So what do we do? Where do we draw the line? And do we risk being really harsh disciplinarian and saying, nope, 9 o'clock, absolutely 9 o'clock, and that's it. And it really depends on the situation. And it depends on what the risks are in either direction. So, for example, if we're doing a drug trial and we want to see if the drug is safe, then we should put a really big safe buffer zone around where it is that we're trying to be. And it's the same is true with, for example, the legal alcohol limit for driving, that the possible consequences there are terrible accidents and injury and death. And so if we say that this is the legal limit for alcohol, even though 0.0001 of a milligram or however it's measured, a little tiny bit more wouldn't make any difference. We should be harsh about it because the possible consequences are so terrible. And so we put the limit smaller than maybe some people could take and still drive safely because we don't want to take that kind of risk. And so actually it's another question of false positives and false negatives. And sexual harassment is another example of this because what often happens is that people don't report something that if it's not that bad, because you kind of, and I've done this myself, something happens that has been off-putting and I go, oh, but it wasn't really terrible and I don't want to waste, am I going to waste someone's time by reporting it and causing a fuss and maybe they didn't mean that badly, but then it might escalate a tiny bit. And then you go, well, that was only a tiny bit worse than that other thing. And then it escalates a bit more. And some people escalate things very gradually, specifically so that there's no sensible point where you can say, well, now it's definitely awful. And you can only say now it's definitely completely inappropriate when it's gone so far down the line that you really should have reported it. You wish you had reported it way further back than that. And so I think that is a situation like the legal alcohol limit and like with drug tests where we should draw the line earlier if we care about protecting victims. And so it should be acceptable to report things much earlier before they become really terrible, so that we don't have to get into the point where it's terrible and where we will then be traumatized already by the situation.
What's the logical flaw in straw man arguments?
Straw man arguments are all around us. And again, I see them everywhere on the internet all the time. And I think there was one in the clip that you played at the beginning of this show, actually. Now, I don't like gendering things unnecessarily, so I do like calling them straw person arguments sometimes. And the point is, a straw person is something where you replace the real argument with another one that's much weaker, like a straw person who's much easier to knock down. And then you knock it down. And if you do that, you haven't actually defeated anybody's argument. All you've done is defeated an argument that nobody was making in the first place. But if you do it with panache and vigor, then you can fool people into thinking that you really have defeated their argument. And in the clip that you played at the beginning, I think that Cruz said, you seem to think that putting more protection in schools is thoughts and prayers. And that is a straw man argument, because the other person wasn't claiming that thoughts and prayers are just the same as putting more people with weapons into schools. He was simply saying that thoughts and prayers by themselves don't achieve very much, or don't achieve enough, in his opinion. And it was replaced with an argument that's very easy to knock down, which is claiming that thoughts and prayers are exactly the same as putting people with more weapons in schools. And everybody can see that that's not true. And so that's a straw person argument.
The logic of personal responsibility is really interesting as you explore it here. So you note that there are people who oppose universal health care on the basis of their belief that everybody should take responsibility for themselves. And that, you know, there's a logic to that. But you note that their argument doesn't tend to extend to whether we think public roads should exist.
Yes. And one of the things that abstract mathematics teaches us is that if you use some kind of abstract general argument to support something, if that's truly a general argument, then it should apply all over the place as well. So if you say that you believe that everyone should take responsibility for themselves, and thus we should have no healthcare, no universal healthcare, then we can test your principle by applying it to other places, such as roads and police and firefighters. Should everybody take responsibility for building their own road? Should everyone take responsibility for putting out their own fires if your house catches fire? I think most people don't think that. I mean, there are people who live in the woods in a hut and just want to defend themselves with their own weapons, but that's an extreme. And I think most of the people that we tend to get into arguments with aren't quite that extreme. And so if we realize that's not a completely universal argument, then instead we can look for some more nuance in it. So we can say, instead of everyone should take responsibility for themselves, no, they shouldn't, we can say, under what circumstances should people take responsibility for themselves? Why are there some things where you believe in collective responsibility and some other things where you don't believe in collective responsibility? And then we can maybe discover that we're not so different after all. Hopefully, we all believe in collective responsibility for some things and not for some other things. And so I don't believe that there are some Kickstarters out there where some people seem to think that everyone should take collective responsibility for funding their giant lavish wedding, for example. And I don't particularly believe in that. So we all have things that where we do and don't believe in collective responsibility, and then we can have a more nuanced argument about why some of us believe in some things and not others. And is it because, for example, some people think that healthcare is not a necessity, whereas roads are a necessity? And in that case, we can think about what counts as a necessity and what doesn't count as a necessity, instead of just having an argument where someone says, you just don't believe in individual responsibility.
And of course, that's not to say that you can't object to universal health care and support public roads, right? Because the logic should work in the other direction as well.
Right. It's there is a logic that means you can support one of those things and not the others. It's just that if you give a flawed logic, then that's not good enough to show that you're being logical. There might well be something else where it might simply be that you think that health care counts as something like an optional service that not everybody wants. And indeed, there are some people who really don't want healthcare. They've decided it's not something they think it's worth spending money on, and they think they should have the right to make that decision. And that is a perfectly logical position.
All right, I want to talk about false equivalence. You bring up the argument here. You know, some people will say girls and boys can play with the same toys. They should be marketed the same. Other people say, well, that looks like an effort to turn boys into girls and girls into boys and eliminate the differences. It's the kind of argument that gets made by politicians all the time to discredit something that their adversaries endorse.
Mm-hmm. And so in that example, some people say, we should just let boys be boys and let girls be girls. And it's a false equivalence. And the false equivalence is claiming that just because we don't put genders on toys anymore, we're going to force boys to be girls and force girls to be boys. And there is simply nothing in the argument that claims that we're going to force boys to be girls and girls to be boys. All we're saying is that boys and girls can play with the same toys if they want to, and that we shouldn't make them feel bad for playing with a toy that's labeled with the opposite gender from the one that they are, or indeed if they don't want to have any particular gender at all. So those false equivalences are everywhere, but it takes a little bit of care sometimes to spot them. And it, it takes a bit more time to really unpack what someone is saying and the sense in which it is not equivalent to the thing that they think they're saying. And again, it's a case where slowing down an argument is really important, and it might not be possible in the kind of arguments we get into on Twitter, where if you do say something longer than 280 characters, it goes in some long thread, and it then becomes extremely complicated trying to pinpoint the part of the argument that went wrong. However, I wish that we could all slow down our arguments, and instead of just trying to have the final say and close it down all at once, to really unpack whether or not the point someone is making is really equivalent to the point that is trying to be made.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It does always surprise me that people, the moment something, some piece of news has reached the world and maybe been disseminated on Twitter, lots of people instantly have a really strong opinion about it. And I, maybe it's the journalist in me thinking, but I always feel like I don't have nearly enough information to decide yet.
Yes, I think that having an immediate opinion is not a terrible thing. It's a human reaction. We need to have instant reactions to situations. That's how we respond to a fast-paced world, to possible danger, to meeting new people. We need to form instant opinions. The thing that's really important, though, is to be open to changing them when new information comes in. So I can have a gut reaction to something, and that's fine, but I will only give it the value of a gut reaction. I won't decide that it's a logical opinion, but it's still a valid gut reaction. The thing about being a rational human is not to eliminate those gut reactions and emotions, but to be open to changing them when better information comes in. And so if my gut reaction to a person is that they are perhaps arrogant and they think a lot of themselves, if I then talk to them for longer and discover that actually they were just shy and not presenting themselves well, then I should be able to change my mind about that. And one sign that someone is really not being rational is if there are no circumstances at all under which they would change their mind. And so, for example, it happens when we over-idolize stars. So people sometimes idolize Hollywood actors or musicians, and just they refuse to believe that that person could ever have done anything wrong, even when huge quantities of accusations or allegations or evidence come in. And that is a sign that someone is not being rational. It's an irrational support. There's a fine line and a gray area between loyalty, which I think is a wonderful human thing, and blind loyalty, where you refuse to believe anything, all the information that's coming in. And on the other side of that, there's also a fine line between healthy skepticism, which is a very important aspect of being rational. We should be skeptical of information coming at us so that we can check to see whether it's really correct or not. But then there is blind skepticism, where some people refuse to believe anyone is an expert in anything, and they think that everybody's opinion is equally valid. And that's a very dangerous situation that we're getting into, where those people have no framework that they would use to assess when one thing is more valid than something else. So at both extremes, there are problems, both with blind loyalty and with blind skepticism. There's a gray area in between them that we've already discussed gray areas. And if we could be more nuanced about those things, we might be able to see, for example, that a gut reaction is fine and an instant opinion is fine, but we should always be open to changing our mind in the face of better information.
Eugenia Chang is scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Her new book is called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. Eugenia, it's been such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
If you're interested in Think, you can follow our Facebook feed. You can also find us on Twitter. The handle is @KERAThink. My Twitter handle is @ChrisBoydThink. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, you can use any of the many podcast apps that are out there. The Think podcast is free. You can become a subscriber and never miss an episode of the show. If you do sign up, make sure you leave us a review. If you want to find what we have coming up on Think, you can check out the website think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.